Hey everyone, welcome along. V8's Loot Podcast powered by Repco. It's a Q&A edition. We are dipping into the mailbag because we haven't for a while. So the letters, well no, there's not really letters. There's email, there's social questions that have been building up for the last month or so. So we thought we'd better rip into them in this episode. We've got plenty of questions, plenty of answers. Will Dale is alongside me. Will, welcome back to World HQ here at the podcast headquarters. No, it's just the office within the office, really. But we haven't done one of these for a little while. This is weird looking at you across the table.
No, normally you find yourself looking at other people. So I guess you see me most days. So I don't know what to make of that.
One thing you do have today, you have your Perkins Engineering trucker cap on.
I do.
Now, I'm not sure if Jack's got any more of these left, but I did see online that Perkins Engineering have those caps. So if anyone's looking for one, follow Perkins Engineering online, chase up Jack via the socials, ask him at a racetrack. I'm not sure if he's got any stock left, or maybe you bought the last one. But
I hope not. For other punters' sake who want one, I hope it's not the last one.
Oh, I hope it's not. It's a ripper. It's very.
If not, there are alternate versions. There's the camo version. There's the Perkins Agricultural version.
Are you not getting a cut?
I'm not. I'm just saying.
You should. We've pulled you away from the keyboard long enough to jump on this podcast with me. You've been, along with Stefan Bartholomew, doing an awesome job talking to former owners of Perkins cars, talking to current owners, going right back through the history. The book's coming together, the history of the Perkins Engineering cars. Later in the year, it comes out in time for October. You've been buried in the NZVKs, though, of late, haven't you?
Yeah, it's been good fun. Or the VKs and also into the VLs. And like it's an era of the sport that I really love. And, of course, all of the Perkins Commodores were such a big part of that. And finding out like cool little details about them, It's exciting. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, there's a few nuggets of gold that we will have in this book for later in the year. Some amazing photos that have never been published before. If you're not across it, it'll be out later in the year. It's a limited edition book. It will be limited to just 2,500 numbered copies. They will be all signed by Larry Perkins as well. So jump on our website, bookshop.v8sleuth.com.au, to get your pre-order in. Make sure you don't miss out when we tell you to pre-order. Pre-order, because our books, like these special edition books, they're a limited edition. Same with the DJR book that we did, same with HRT. Once they're gone, they're gone. We don't reprint them. That's just how it is. So make sure you order up and get ready. Now, let's go in. I'll start with a new ball. Have you got your bat ready to take a swing?
Yes.
That's a cricket reference, by the way, Will. Shane Jones, what's the record? This is good. For most teams with wins in a season, we've had five different teams win so far this year. Have we had any higher in previous seasons?
It's funny. You think of five being quite a high number, but we have actually had substantially more than that in the past, even in the relatively recent past. So we've dug through the numbers, and the biggest in the sport's history.
And we're talking race wins here, aren't we?
Yes, we are talking race wins.
Yep.
Race wins in the 10 different teams. 10 different teams.
When?
Have a guess. When do you think?
10 different teams. Well, it's clearly got to be in a period where there's been lots of races.
Yes, that is correct.
So we've been multiple races since the mid-90s with three races since 96 generally.
Yep.
And then maybe hold it on lots of stuff.
I'll drop in a hint.
Yeah.
It's also after they introduced Enduros into the championship.
Oh, okay. So, yeah. All right.
Adding even more races and a bit more variety.
Adds a few more to it, doesn't it, a little bit? There's probably a year where there was a lot of one-off winners. A handful of sprinklings of, what about 2000?
Spot on.
Oh, really?
Yeah. No, that's the one. Because you remember they also had in 2000 full race reverse grid at Canberra.
Yep.
And they started reversing the top six in race two at a lot of sprint events.
They were trying to mix it up without mixing it up fully.
Yes.
So, who, okay, 10 teams, clearly HRT were.
Oh, naturally, yeah.
Craig Baird won at Phillip Island for Stones.
That's two.
DJR Radisich.
Correct.
He broke the drought at Sandown, didn't he, later? And Ellery. Ellery won
Ellery
that weekend
well.
Too. So that's another team. So there's four.
That's four.
Ingle won one of those reverse top six races, I think, Oran Park, wasn't it?
Yep. Yes, he did.
So that's five.
So that's five.
Well, GRM, because Garth Tander won a bunch of stuff that year.
Six.
Steve Richards won at Calder.
Yep. Seven.
Todd Kelly won in Canberra.
Holden Young Lions.
Yeah, that's separate to HRT.
Yes.
That was a separate from the same Clayton Business Park, but from different workshops and different team structures. So that year, basically HYL of 2000 became Kmart Racing for 01.
Hmm.
What are we up to? Is that eight?
I believe so. Yes. That is eight.
Oh, Calder, Larko.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
After the Oran Park shunt in the new car.
Yep. He won the top six reverse
at Red Calder, so that's nine.
Yeah. There's a good one here you're missing. I recently did a book on him.
Oh, Cedo.
Yes. Yeah.
Ford Tickford Racing. Where did he? Winton. Oh, that's Winton. Right. Yeah.
Last race win of his career.
It was too. So 10 different teams winning then.
Yeah.
Isn't it strange? Because such a period of domination of the people who won the championships then, because we were very much in a HRT, was that five in a row they won?
Yeah.
And that's the mid part of those five.
And you think of that year as being one that was largely dominated by HRT, but a lot of other teams did win races.
But they won one.
Yes.
Like Ellery was one. Larkham was one. Cedo was one. Todd Kelly won.
Yep. I think Gibson won a couple.
Murph won in Canberra.
Yeah, he won.
And Richards won at Calder, so they didn't win many. GRM, that was multiples because Bugs did a bit of winning at Winton and Tander did a bit, and they both won Bathurst. Perkins, I think Russell
won. Not as much.
Won,
there was a couple.
Small amount. Yeah. Stones was a one win for Berto.
Yeah.
And DJR, was it one win for Radisich?
He won a couple at Sandown and also took one at Eastern Creek.
Yeah. Okay.
I think.
So, not heap, but the bulk lion's share, literally, were with HRT. So. Okay, so if that, what's been the best number in the more recent era, though?
It's funny. It's another year where you probably would associate it more with one team dominating. It was 2016, where Triple Eight went on this big tear from about halfway through, from Townsville onwards, and dominated the rest of the season. But a total of eight teams won that year. So, in addition,
but it was the same formula? Lots of teams winning one race and minimal number of races?
Yeah. I think that's a pretty fair assessment.
It still counts for the stat.
Oh, totally. Totally. So, Triple Eight, Holden Racing Team in their final year, of course, took Sandown 500 and Courtney won in Adelaide.
Yep.
Nick Perkat won for LDM in Adelaide.
Yes. Plug.
Yep.
No plug.
Adelaide
500 book. Adelaide
500
it's nearly
book.
Here.
Yes.
We've got an advanced copy that's landed in the office this week from offshore that's been air freighted to us. The rest are on the boat coming. We're expecting them mid-June. So 400 pages, full colour, amazing illustrated history, the Adelaide 500 hardcover book. You can pre-order it now from our website, bookshop.v8sleuth.com.au. We'll tell the world when it's here available to buy, but if you pre-order, we'll obviously send yours out first. So just a little one there. So Triple Eight HRT, LDM in 2016.
Your Bathurst winners, Techno.
Techno, that's right. Yep. McLaughlin in the Volvo.
Correct. GRM. A couple of wins for Pro Drive with Mark Winterbottom.
Yep. Tim Slade at Winton.
Yes.
BJR.
And Michael Caruso for Kelly Racing at Hidden Valley.
Okay. So there's the eight.
Yeah.
I'm looking now at a list because this makes
my life
a lot
easier.
I've handed
across the table to you.
Yeah, thank you.
So I'm not doing all the hard work.
No, that's good. I like it. I'm not surprised that 2013 is the other year that there are eight different teams win. First year of Car of the Future and a few one-off wins and a few rarities, but Triple Eight, Techno, BJR, GRM, FPR, HRT, DJR with Chas Mostert at Queensland Raceway, and Kelly's with James Moffat in the Nissan at Winton that year. So those last two are the one-win wonders, but everybody else, I think, was largely multiple.
And you think back to that year, it's kind of the situation we're in at the moment where we've had a long streak of different winners. 2013 had the record for different drivers winning races in a sequence. And
it's nine, I think it was.
Yeah, it was.
From memory,
yeah.
We looked that up during the week. So, I mean, there's been plenty of years that there's been a fair variety. And of course, this number really is achieved by, you only have to win one to get on the list to make this work. But 2000, it's really funny. I guess time changes things for you, that you have a perception of things that it was a domination era, and really it was, because they won the bulk of the races, they won the championship, but other teams got a little bit of a nibble of the pie along the way. But, I mean, it was done with a reverse grid race in Canberra and a couple of those reverse six races. So there was gimmicks at play to do that. So look at 13 and 16 to get eight teams win. There was the introduction of a whole new car platform. And in 16, it had been around for a few years. But no reverse grid races, no, you know, weird gimmicks and reverse sixes. So
it's funny. You know what's next on the list with a year that seven teams won in? 1976.
So that's the year that the Enduros were added to the championship, except
for
Bathurst
time.
For the first time. And there were a couple of rounds with two races as well. So there are probably more races potentially in that year's championship than they'd been in the years before and in some of the years afterwards. So opens up the window a little bit. But so that's the year. So Moffat won for himself, but he also won in Goss's car.
Exactly. Because
so if you count that as Moffat, like they're both wins for Alan Moffat Racing, or no, Gossie's team gets
Gossie's
a win?
Team.
Gossie's team, Gossie's car, or Gossie's car, Moffat's team?
Ooh, interesting. Ooh. Interesting.
Nevertheless, it's a cool topic, and it's a really interesting one. 2000, Shane Jones, 10 teams won in that season. Pretty cool.
Yes. Next question from Braden McKay. What's the V8 Sleuth's thoughts on whether Car of the Future will get a run in 2022? And if so, will they have another aero reduction hot on the heels of the one that they did recently to try and improve the racing?
Yeah. I personal feeling, I think they're going to end up running the current cars for the first part of next year. I just can't see them delaying the start of the year and moving round one back to April, May to start afresh with the new cars to allow more testing and more time to build. And like, I don't think that's feasible because then it jams up your year
in the back completely end. Yeah. In the back Unless end. You're going to shift it to a summer season, which I don't think is on the table.
Yeah, no, I can't see that happening. So I just – there's so much work to do. I just – at best, I think that's the case, that the Gen 3 cars start the midpoint of next year. Maybe we have we're going to have, 6 or 7 weeks off in the middle of this year with a bit of a gap in the championship. Maybe that's the natural point next year where you have that break and then reset for a couple of months and then
which is a wild thing to think of a championship being conducted half with one spec of car and half with another spec of car.
I can't think of another – well, actually, no, I can think of one series where that's happened.
Mm-hmm.
The Indy Racing League. The second year.
Yes.
So
we're
diverting here, but in 96 when the IRL began, they had three races because they wanted to finish with the Indy 500. So that carried them into a non-calendar year season. So the first season of IRL was 1996 when the CART were doing their own thing. We're getting an IndyCar lesson here, everyone, by the way. Three races made up the inaugural IRL series, and then they started again not long after in 1996 calendar year. They ran a couple of races late 96 with the existing X-Kart turbocharged cars, and then they brought in the 4-litre V8 stock block engines and the new Dallaras and G-Forces, or the Oldsmobile and Nissan engines, for the first race of the 97 calendar year at Walt Disney World Speedway, which is not there anymore. But it was actually, I think, round 2 or 3 or whatever it was of the 96-97 season.
Yeah.
So that's the only time I can think of a series that has implemented a whole car platform change in the middle of an actual point scoring season. I can't think. There's probably others, but
and they had intended on finishing their calendar year with Indy, but then they decided, no, let's transition back to an actual calendar year season. So they just ran out the rest of the 97 year anyway.
Yeah, exactly right. But I can't see Gen 3 being there ready to rumble for a first round in Newcastle
there's
in February.
There's so much to do.
There's been,
when you compare where they were with Car of the Future in 2012 compared to where they are with Gen 3 this
2011
year.
Sorry, 2011. Testing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. There's plenty of positivity, but there's plenty of optimism. And I'm a glass half full kind of guy, not a glass half empty, but I'm also a bit of a realist too. And I've been around long enough and seen it long enough that,
it's a big ask.
It's a huge ask. And I think that a lot of people jump on supercars for a lot of different things. I think they've got the formula of what they're going to do right. It's like baking a cake, which, by the way, I'm no good at. But you've got to get the right ingredients. You've got to have the right recipe, but then you've got to cook it right. You've got to bake it right. So there's no point here in getting the best cake mix possible, doing it the best way with the best recipe, and then
under-baking
completely stuffing up the cooking bit because you're left with a disaster on your hands, and they can't afford to do this given off the back of, we're still in COVID. I can't see it.
And the second half of his question, I don't see them, if they do indeed run Car of the Future into the first half of next year, I don't see them changing the spec and reducing error. It's another cost for teams at a time when they're chasing their own tails trying to get Gen 3 up and running. As good as it would be to see them take the aero reduction a bit further, I just don't see it happening for this generation of car.
It raises an interesting question too, which we haven't discussed before. We discussed this, but with the clear plot and plan that it would seem from the outside that the plan is that once Gen 3 cars are introduced, that the current ZBs, Commodores, and Mustangs go to the Super 2 series. And then what's in Super 2 now, FGX Falcon, VF Commodore, Nissan Altima, they go to Super 3.
Mm.
And then everything before that, Project Blueprint cars, kind of spits back off to probably V8 touring cars as it used to be.
Mm.
So here's the thing. If supercars introduce Gen 3 partway through next year, well, if you're Matt White or Eggleston's or, you know, all those Super 2 teams, the last thing you're going to want is a change of platform to your series partway through.
Oh, yes.
But if you're a main game team, I think there's some team. I mean, some teams have already done deals to sell their main game cars for next year to Super 2 teams, but with a caveat that we might need these things back. We can't quite – we've got the deal agreed,
but there might be a delivery date
that becomes a little bit later. So anyway, that's a whole other thing to consider as well.
It's a very, very big snowball.
Yeah, yeah. I wouldn't want to stand in the way of that one. Mm. Matt Bottrell is a regular listener, loves the podcast. He's got a couple – it's a bit of a multi-part question, so I'll slice it up.
Yep.
It's about crashed chassis.
Mm.
So he says, when a chassis is destroyed, like Chaz Mostert's in 2015 at Bathurst or Mark Scaife's at Eastern Creek, so 1995 Winfield Triple Challenge, who determines that it's a write-off, the teams or supercars?
Well, ultimately, if supercars feels a car's not safe to take to the racetrack, it's ultimately they will say no. But realistically, the teams know. Like they would not want to put a car on track that's A, not safe, and B, not fit to turn a lap time that they know it's capable of. So it's kind of column A and column B in that sense.
They both contribute, really.
Yeah.
I've never heard of a team trying to say, yeah, it'll be fine.
Yeah.
And supercars saying, no, or vice versa. So definitely the case. Speaking of that Chaz Mostert wreck, we love telling the story, but it survives. It should have been crushed. It was going to be probably crushed by Tickford, or Pro Drive as they were then. It now lives at the National Motor Racing Museum at Mount Panorama Bathurst. So if you're in Bathurst for an event or heading through that part of Central West New South Wales, stop in. Go and have. Don't do it on Tuesday. Actually, because they're closed on Tuesdays, but they are open 6 days a week. Otherwise, head to the museum's Bathurst website to get all the details and follow the National Motor Racing Museum on Facebook. They've got a very active Facebook account. They're always posting photos and videos of what cars are arriving or leaving for displays. Got some good plans ahead for later on in the year, just quietly. Other part to Matt's question, are chassis automatically written off if there's a fatality?
See, generally, it's an awkward question, but generally, the accidents in the supercars era that have caused fatalities, the crash has been so severe that the car's been damaged beyond repair. So as a function of that, it is written off and would never come back to a racetrack. Some of the cars have then undergone further analysis by supercars or other bodies associated with the sport to learn things about what's occurred in the crash and how to make cars better. But generally, cars that have been involved in fatalities are written off just as a result.
And I think anyway, even if there was a car that was repairable after an accident like that, there wouldn't be the heart or the feeling there to want to do it. Scott McLaughlin's chassis from the Gold Coast 2019, the Bathurst winning car, he asks, has that been totally rebuilt for the Penske Museum? Can it be used on the track for ride days, or does written off mean written off?
Theoretically, I guess it could be used, but it's one of those things where there's the Mustang that's already in the US, the one that Ford Global CEO Jim Farley was having a run around in last week.
There's a story on our website about that if you haven't caught up with it, vhsleuth.com.au.
So that car is over there on the proviso that it's got different, it doesn't have some of the aero bits.
No,
that would
under
be
tray.
Of,
yeah.
Yeah. It's and missing a different a bunch of ECU. Stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's missing a bunch of stuff that you couldn't deem it. You couldn't put it on a track and deem it really learning anything from it from a testing point of view, which was always – that was a Falcon to start its life with, and then it got re-skinned as a Mustang because they were pretty keen on having a Mustang car that looked the same as what was racing out here over there.
Yeah. Go on.
I was going to say with that Bathurst winning McLaughlin car that he – this is the one that he barrel rolled down the chicane at the Gold Coast and fired a spring up to the balcony there somewhere at some point. They chopped – they being Pace Innovations, the chassis constructors, they chopped the damaged back end off that car, put a whole new rear end on it because they want it to be really nice. And it's back at the DJR workshop in Queensland now and is being put back together and will head to the United States with a bunch of Penske cars that I think it's Fabian Coulthard's car that won the first race for them in 2017.
Yep, at Simmons.
McLaughlin's championship-winning Falcon, his championship-winning Mustang, and, of course, this car being the Bathurst winner as well. So Penske's museum's in Scottsdale, Arizona,
yes,
isn't it? And Neil Crompton did a visit there a couple of years ago and did a documentary with Roger Penske at the museum. And Roger generally doesn't do that sort of stuff. So talking to Cromley, so it's a pretty amazing place. So hopefully, you know, COVID different land, we can get over there and go and have a look at some of the captain's cool stuff.
Because all those cars are in absolutely immaculate concourse condition, which is probably another reason why that car would not be used for track and ride days.
No such thing as a dirty, grimy, Penske famous car.
It's not the Penske way.
No, no.
Next question from Adam Hughes. Why doesn't Supercars invest in an over 40s / retired V8 drivers category? Something, I guess, like the Masters PGA Tour. Would be ace to see all the oldies have a bash again against each other. Adam, I think you've answered your own question as to why that might not happen.
Yeah, I'm not sure that's a good investment. He uses the word investment. That's a way to tear up money, letting those crazy bastards loose in a bunch of race cars. Nice theory. Costs a lot of money to be able to turn on something like that. However, I'm really interested. I can draw a comparison here. That thing that Ray Evenham's running in the US.
Yeah, SRX?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's kind of bringing together retired racing stars. I think there's a CBS TV deal. Tony Stewart's a partner in it with him. They've built like a – what would you describe the car as? It's like a spec race car that's got a body on it that can run short ovals, and
it's made
for TV racing.
Yeah, it looks cool. Like, it looks really cool.
And there's 12, 15 different names that have been mentioned with, I think Danica Patrick's going to be part of the TV team for it.
Yeah.
I think Mark Webber was announced that he was going to
Have a run. Willie T. It. Ribbs.
Yeah.
Bunch of dudes that know what they're doing.
There's probably, I don't see it as being something, as per Adam's question, that supercars would do. But if you took the Evenham concept and you approached it as a made for television spectacle, invited a bunch of famous drivers that will bring attention, plus some VIP type names, an Eric Banner or someone along those lines to come and have a run. If I was going to be starting a new motor racing little category.
There were starting
with
points.
With a bit of cash. That wouldn't be a bad one to do. But, nice idea, Adam, but I can't see it happening anytime soon. It's a bit cheaper to go and play on the seniors PGA Tour with a bag
Thomas.
Of golf clubs and, join Thomas with some spikes and some shoes and some clubs.
It's funny because you think of the instances where this has been tried in the past, and this is the SRX category is very different. But you remember GP Masters?
Yeah, that lasted a while.
Yeah, with all the old champ cars.
They're all buggered after the poor blokes that were like in their 40s and 50s, but running cars that were built based off a 99 Raynard.
Yeah.
And I reckon half of them couldn't hold their neck up after lap five.
Probably the best thing I've seen that's along the lines of what Adam's proposing. So back in the day, Charlotte Motor Speedway, before the Winston, hosted basically a race with older model stock cars for legends of the sport.
Oh, I read about this.
Yeah, there's vision of it on the internet. It's amazing because they absolutely didn't care about the cars whatsoever. They just tore into each other. There was a lot of chrome horn usage, and there was probably not a straight panel left on any of the cars by the end of the race.
Sounds like my kind of thing. Yeah. Send me the web link.
Next question from Michael Pascoe. Hi, V8 Sleuth. Awesome podcast.
Thank you, Michael.
I have more of a suggestion than a question.
This feels a bit more gentle than a demand. This is good.
I just heard Barry Ryan talking a little about him, but how about a John Faulkner podcast? He did Oscar, NASCAR, Supercars. I apologize if it's been done, but I can't remember it from your extensive catalogue. Keep up the great work.
Thanks, Michael. Well, it hasn't been done. And the good news is I have been in communications with JF, and he is all good for me to do a pod with him sometime soon.
That's exciting.
So plan is to sit down with him very, very soon. So look forward to hearing that one somewhere down the track. It's a nice little segue too to a new partner of ours on the podcast, themotorsporttrader.com. It's your online place to keep your motorsport memories alive. Basically, Luke and his team deal in motorsport memorabilia, panels, wheels, all sorts of quirky stuff, cool stuff, bonnets, wheels, panels off cars, V8 supercars, other race cars, GT cars. It's got an amazing variety on his website. And I had a look the other day, by the way, and it reminded me of this too. It's a nice segue to the John Faulkner stuff. Remember when JF ran the Stars and Stripes bonnet on the Dynapack Commodore of his post-September 11?
Yeah.
Huge American connection with Faulkner. He raced NASCARs and went to the States and bought a lot of his cars from over there and had a nice affinity to the US. That bonnet's for sale on the motorsporttrader.com. So head to the website, check it out. There's a bunch of other really cool stuff, the motorsporttrader.com. Eddie Bent next up on the podcast with a question. Yeah, this is not bad. We've done some classic cars in the past. He's got a suggestion. How about a podcast about the most expensive paperweight ever made? The DJR EB1 Falcon from 1992.
He calls it an expensive paperweight. The car did eventually go racing. It just took about 25 years for it to happen.
Yeah, not with Dick Johnson driving.
Not with Dick Johnson driving and not in a top-level supercars touring car race. But it did go racing once it was eventually sold off by DJR because they used it as a, it had a long life as a show car.
Yeah, you probably got your photo taken with it as a kid along the line, didn't you?
Yeah, I think I and a lot of other people would have. But yeah, that car, once the team upgraded to AU Falcons and you couldn't
it
make
didn't
an
look
e-
the same anymore,
you couldn't make
it?
An E-Series Falcon look like an AU.
EF to EL sort of was okay, but
so the team eventually sold it to Western Australia. Mm. Car was eventually logbooked and turned into a race or.
Sports sedan.
Went racing over there for quite a long time and is now with a new owner who actually approached us when we were working on the DJR book and said, I've got the car, and he's working towards restoring it. Last I talked to him, it's going back to how it was when it was last with DJR as a show car, but the ultimate goal is to return it back to how it was at the Bathurst Test Day in 92.
Ah, that's great info, but you know what you've just done.
I've just ruined the idea of having a podcast
on your own.
Yeah. Oh, well. It's all right. We'll clip it out. We'll run it separate. It's fine.
No. It's good. It's good. There's plenty of insight to be grabbed from people at the time who were involved with that car. Adrian Fuller is a chassis nerd. He makes us look like not as nerdy. But Adrian loves his chassis, which is awesome. He's got a question. Are there any Gen 2 chassis partly constructed that haven't raced yet? Example, KR010, which is a Kelly Racing chassis that hasn't been completed. He read recently that Kelly Grove have announced that there's going to be a new chassis for Andre Heimgartner this year at some point, which he assumes is that one. He mentions the LDM chassis that never raced that we have discussed previously on the pod and on our website. I can't think of any other chassis that teams have got floating around that haven't run yet.
And now would be the time to be building it up. Mm. As we saw at the end of the Project Blueprint era, teams that had leftover shells in their inventory thought, oh, we need to build these and race them so they actually have a bit of a history.
Yeah, because there actually is a rule. Oh, I don't know if it's still in the ops manual, but I haven't gone that deeply on it for quite some
time. Thou shalt not introduce a brand new car into Super 2 rule.
Correct, but thou hath been permitteth to do so over the years. I was trying to just go along with it there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There have been cars in the past that were built new for Super 2, whether it was to replace a crashed car or to was left over from a team. It was a Tasman car that was a built chassis from the Tasman Motorsport team that closed down, but it was of the same spec and era and everything as the sister cars, so it was given the seal of approval. So it can happen. Supercars can and do give it the tick, but I can't think of any others apart from that one at Kelly's that's been, I think, sitting there for quite some time, but is going to become a Mustang for Andre Heimgartner at some point.
A car that wasn't a Nissan first.
Yeah, which is what Andre's current car was. It was Gary Jacobson's Nissan. It's now Andre's Mustang.
Yeah.
Andre won't know himself because he's just gone and had a run in that Aston Martin sports sedan, which has probably got not very many Aston Martin bits in it. So I'll tell you what, that actually raises a really good point to segue just before we go to the next question.
Mm.
You know what I've actually realized that I didn't know until I stopped and saw Heimgartner doing the sports sedan?
Mm-hmm.
I'm loving seeing supercar drivers driving other stuff regularly.
It's great, isn't it?
It's a bit of a breath of fresh air because we've sort of always been attuned in the last 10, 15 years, that they're supercars drivers.
Yeah.
And anytime one of them does something else, it's weird and it's strange and it's out there and it's very different. But now we're seeing, you know, Van Gisbergen doing GTs in the Bathurst 6 hour. We've seen Chas Mostert in TCR and GTs. Heimgartner doing the sports sedan thing. Van Gisbergen talking about going and doing some Australian rallying. I feel like the walls have come down a little bit on all that stuff. People are looking beyond their 12 or 13 weekends a year of supercars at opportunities that are out there to drive other stuff. I think it's good.
That's great. Like, Shane for so long was the only person doing that, like, or in a position to do that. He'd be the guy who was always trying to jump into a sports car somewhere or anything with four wheels and he'd race it. But it is positive to see that teams are letting their drivers go out and race things to stay match fit in between race weekends. It can't be a bad thing. Like, obviously there's inherent risk anytime someone gets into a race car and heads out onto a track, but it's good to see that they're letting drivers go out and do what they do.
There is risk every time they ride their mountain bikes training as well, as we learned earlier this year.
Yes, indeed. Next question from Tristan Lewis. What happened to the, and this is in quotation marks, Fortador from the 1983 Bathurst 1000? Now, he, I assume, is referring to the car that replaced Andrew Harris's Falcon, which he gave to Dick, as he gave his Falcon to Dick Johnson and Kevin Bartlett to become Green's Tough Mark II.
Yeah, so the Andrew Harris Commodore that he and Gary Cook raced in the Bathurst 1000 after the car swap, so his Falcon went to Dick Johnson, was the Barry Lawrence car that had been practiced earlier that weekend. So a deal was done. It was repainted. I think it had the Ford badge on it, did it not?
It did,
and it had backing from the Bendigo Ford dealer at the time. So hence why it got dubbed the Fortador. You know what? That's a car I've never sat there and done a pile of research on or really thought about. So I'm sure there's some Group C Commodore touring car expert listeners of the podcast who can send us a note and tell us otherwise. But I have a feeling, just a feeling, that that car may have ended up a sports sedan. Maybe that was the Rita Owadala car some years later. I'm not quite sure off the top of my head. But
if so, that car had a few big shunts.
Yeah, yeah. So that's the car that's kind of forgotten in the whole car swap thing of 83 Bathurst. Everyone talks about the car that Dick put in the trees and then the Falcon that replaced it, that was the Andrew Harris car that started its life as the Alan Jones and Bob Morris Seiko car back in, what, 82.
Another car that had a few big
hits. Yeah, its luck didn't get any better, no. Did it? But, yeah, if you know more about the Barry Lawrence Commodore that became the Andrew Harris Commodore, love to hear from you. We'd love to put together a story or a follow-up on the pod at some point in the future. Benjamin Woodley. Benjamin's question is about, where is Mark Scaife's infamous clutch failure chassis? That's the Bathurst 2006 car, HRT 054.
And the answer is not still trying to get up the mountain.
No, there's probably a few bits of it left there on the run-up mountain straight. Where is it?
That car's over in Western Australia, I believe.
That's right, it is too. Yep, it is. It's a private owner over there who has put it back to the Bathurst 06 livery with the black bonnet, with the black line, which, of course, was in reference to Peter Brock, who'd passed away, what, a couple of weeks before that.
Yeah, very impressive car, that one, that didn't get the results its speed deserved.
Garth Dander talks about that. I think he talked about it with us on our podcast we did with him in 2019.
Yes. Yeah.
Go back through our back catalogue and have a listen. He said that's the best car he's ever driven at Bathurst. Pulling rev limiter on the run to Skyline. The thing was so... I mean, I remember watching him in that at Sandown in the in the 500. He started the race slowly, was fourth or fifth, I think, in the off the line in the first few laps, and he was back in the lead by lap 10.
Yeah.
That car was the fastest car at Sandown and Bathurst in 06, but double donuts, nothing to show for it.
When it rolled off the trailer at Bathurst on the Thursday in opening practice and it just blitzed everyone, was in a different postcode in that first practice session, you knew it was the car to beat. But alas.
Mm.
Last question from Jeff Schmidt. When was the last time Brocky ran a number other than his signature 05? He's attached a photo to this post. He says, my photo here shows him driving the number 6 at the Adelaide round of the 87 Touring Car Championship after Gary Scott crashed 05. In the lead up to the Lakeside round, so he hopped in the team's other car. Their new VL wasn't finished yet, so he raced as number 6 for the next few races.
Were they just lazy and didn't bother putting 05 on it for the next few rounds?
I've wondered about
it's
that.
It's really weird, isn't it?
Yeah,
like,
yeah. Maybe it's a superstition thing, or I don't know.
They just didn't bother.
Like when Brock hopped in the new VK at Calder in 85 and said, no, I'll just take this one and continue to use the number 7 on it.
That's right. Harvey drove 05 for that Calder weekend. Yeah, I don't know. Probably wasn't a high priority changing the numbers. It was too busy. They were too busy trying to make the cars go fast.
Yeah. So Jeff asks, when was the last time Brocky ran a number other than 05? And has he ever driven with a different number since that 87 touring car?
I've thought of one here.
Yes.
Are we counting? Is this just touring cars or is this anything?
I think this is just touring cars, but lob it up. Let's
production
see.
Cars?
Ooh.
Peugeot 12-hour 1992 number 45.
Where he started the weekend in 05.
Yeah. He and Paul Gover ended up in... So, originally, I think it was Brock, Cromley,
Peter McKay
in 05.
Hmm.
They ran three of these Peugeots in the 12-hour. And they found that the 05 car was a dud. It was slow, no matter what they did. But the 45 car that had a bunch of journos in it, which I think was Paul Gover, who's been on our pod before.
Bob Jennings.
And I can't remember off the top of my head who the other one was. That they swapped cars.
Mm.
But there was a problem. They allowed it, but... one of each of the original car's crew had to stay with their car. So McKay got stuck in the 05 Donkey. Gover stayed in the 45 car and was joined by Brock and Crompton, I think, from memory off the top of my head.
Yep, I reckon you're spot on there. Because Gover talks about that on the podcast we recorded with him.
Yeah, so that's the one that springs to mind for me. But the touring car side of things is probably a cross-entering situation.
That'd be correct. We actually did a story. Well, we actually did a story for the site. I think last year, or maybe even the start of this year, talking about all the numbers that Brock had run in touring car racing, and the most recent one I can think of off the top of my head was when he hopped in Larry's number 11 Commodore at the 1991 Sandown 500
and blew it up.
They all blew up that day.
Yeah, I was there. Yeah, that's right. Started 05, jumped into 11, and
yeah.
Didn't finish in that one either.
But probably the most famous instance directly after the one Jeff was talking about in the middle of 87, he hopped in car 10 at some
That worked out okay, didn't it?
K race.
Yeah, that worked out pretty well, just quietly, I would have thought. And, of course, there was 56 on the BMW in 88.
Ah, yes.
Which he ran late that year.
Yep.
You know what? He did step into 105 at the Sandown 500 in 89. If you look at photos from that, you'll think that Neil Crompton's driving the 105 Sierra.
Yeah.
But he's not.
Yeah.
Because Larko borrowed his spare helmet. There's an interesting, one of those little quirks of history for you to throw in at the very end of our Q&A pod.
I wondered about that. I wonder why that was.
Probably because Larko left his at home. So fair chance. But anyway, thanks everyone for sending in so many questions. We've got plenty more to get through. We always do a call out on socials to keep them flowing. Plenty of cool topics. Just quickly too, before we go, I know so many of our followers love model cars. We've got a little bit of a range in our online store now. If you're a Group C fan, you've got to get the 1/18th scale Nissan Bluebird, the 84 Bathurst pole sitting car of George Bury, Gary Scott. We've got some stock of that from our friends at Authentic Collectibles. Head to our website. It's bookshop.v8sleuth.com.au. If you love your supercars, we've got some stock too of the 2019 Bathurst winning Scott McLaughlin Alex Premer Mustang. Comes with the Peter Brock trophy. Does it come with the Mustang Wins type newspaper?
I think it does.
Banner headline, I think. We've also got stock of the Erebus Chickadee retro car from Sandown 2018 that Dave Reynolds and Luke Yildon put on pole with ZB Commodore. So jump on our website. We've only got pretty limited numbers of those. So jump on, grab one, and add it to your collection. Also, Ford fans, 400 championship wins racked up at the Bend. Recently, we've got a special celebration print, limited edition print. That's in the store as well that you can pre-order. So a bit of stuff to go shopping with for the next couple of weeks to keep everyone on their toes before, of course, the books start flowing later on in the year as we get towards Father's Day, Bathurst, and Christmas. Don't forget Repco Supercars Weekly next Tuesday to wrap up all the action from Winton Motor Raceway, the nation's action track. You've got to say that. It's a contractual obligation.
Yeah.
And we'll be back next Wednesday with another episode of the V8 Sleuth Podcast powered by Repco. Remember, rate, review, and subscribe. And we'll chat to you then.